Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning, welcome to Conversations. Today, two people are my guests who both took a huge risk on each other. My guests are Fiona and Stuart Higgins. Fiona was a Sydney girl when she met Stuart, a Queensland cotton farmer, at an ethical leadership conference. And they seemed to click despite their slightly mismatched backgrounds. And 16 days into their relationship, Stuart sent Fiona a terribly moving love letter attached to a pair of his old farmer's boots. After some false starts, Fiona decided to put, well, everything on the line. And she told Stuart she was coming to live with him on his farm outside Jandowie in country Queensland. Fiona quickly realised that country is like a different country. They do things differently there. And while she took to the life, they both had to live through the worst drought in living memory. Fiona's book on their story is called Love in the Age of Drought, A Career Girl, A Cotton Farmer and an Unlikely Romance. Fiona and Stuart, welcome to you both.
Thanks, Richard.
Morning, Richard.
Fiona, tell me how you actually met the mechanics of that. You went to a conference and there was Stuart all of a sudden. What did you think when you first saw him?
Well, my first impression was actually of his rough rural hands. We met at the registration desk where there were a bunch of name tags, and I was looking for my name tag and he was looking for his, and all of a sudden this great hand reached in front of me and I looked down and I followed the hand up the arm to the face and thought, oh, hello.
Hello. He's a nice-looking young man. Yes.
That's right.
The way Fiona writes about it, Stuart, she didn't come out and say it, but she does say it does seem to have been a case of almost love at first sight. I know these things happen.
There were some eyebrows being raised at each other. So if that's love at first sight, it was certainly, she certainly made an impression on me. And yeah, it stuck big time. I didn't muck around.
How was that first conversation?
Yeah, I think I used the word to describe our first conversation back to Fiona as intriguing. I found the first conversation intriguing. There was she's quite an interesting person, enough to make me want to show more interest. So,
had you ever met anyone like Stuart before?
Well, no. Firstly, I'd never met a farmer prior to meeting Stu. The only experience I'd had with farming was a short visit when I was about five in northwestern Victoria at a sheep station. And at the time, my experience out there actually turned me into a vegetarian. So after that, I hadn't met another farmer, and all I'd seen of farmers really was what I saw on the news, and I think I had a few stereotypes about farmers.
Particularly cotton farmers.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I knew very little even about cotton farming, except that I knew that cotton was a water-intensive crop. So
taking water from the Murray-Darling
all
system.
Of that, yep. All of that. So I had particular views about farmers who I thought tended to be a fairly complaining bunch up on the news banging on about drought. So I had some baggage, I suppose, and then Stuart came along, and he was different to that stereotype, and he was certainly different to any other man I'd previously been romantically interested in as well.
Stuart, was it hard to pick up girls at that stage, because you'd be talking to an attractive woman and within a couple of minutes they'd bring up the ethics of cotton farming?
Yeah, that's normally the great conversation starter. I'm certainly used to that. I've had many years of that. It's hard to find a woman at any stage in rural Australia. It's a lot different to what you see on commercial television. Never had three women vying for my attention, showing them around the farm and saying, I'll pick that one. It always comes into the conversation quite quickly. I'd have to say, thinking back, I don't think Fiona launched into that one straight away. And that was probably another thing that piqued my interest.
Well, what's really interesting about you is that you'd already been heavily involved in the ethical debate about cotton farming through ABC Radio National. Tell me about the Grow Your Own program you were part of.
Well, that came about through some contacts I'd made through the Ethics and Leadership program. One of the people on the program, Kath Dwyer, she went through the program with me, heavily involved in the ABC, Triple J. She was friends with Sarah McDonald. We ended up having some discussions socially all together, and this idea of, you know, surprise, surprise, that conversation came up about cotton and thirsty and environment, and we all sat around and pretty much decided that, you know, if you want to learn about cotton growing, why don't you have a go yourself instead of pointing the finger all the time? So that triggered me giving 5 acres of my farm to the listeners of ABC Radio National Bush Telegraph. And basically I put a series of challenges in front of them, and they had to make the difficult decisions that we as farmers make on trying to produce products from natural resources.
And how did that go? Having some city slickers up on your cotton farm?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. We had it linked to a website, and it ran for the entire length of the season, which is about 8.5 months. To sort of summarise a long process, people were quite idealistic at the start. They're very, you know, we must do it this way. We can't do GM. We can't fertilise it with synthetic. And after a while, I threw in there a few financial imperatives, if we make a bit more money, we'll be donating that to a charity, and we might help some children learn to read a little bit better, or we might help the frontier services out in the far western, you know, Northern Territory and far western Queensland. And very quickly, people's attitudes started turning to, well, if we can help some children, then I think we should go in a little bit harder and start looking after things a little bit differently.
So. Well, I can see this is a really interesting topic, and obviously the subject of a lot of debate, but gee, it must be hard to flirt around that kind of conversation, Fiona. Shocking, shockingly hard. You know, 3 minutes in, you're talking about the ins and outs of cotton farming like that. Was that a little hard?
Oh, no, no. In fact, I remember one of my first lines to Stu was, you know, I really like your website, you know, from that Grow Your Own side.
We have a quirky relationship where we call those types of discussion flirting.
Yeah, so. That's right. I love that. How much water do you use?
Flirting, so you both speak nerd then, in other words, do you? Is that what it was?
We're ethic nerds, all right. So we love challenging each other.
I really like your website.
That's right.
You write in your book, there's this really lovely line. You had this, after meeting him briefly, you write, I wondered briefly how he spent his Sunday mornings. A rogue thought that disconcerted me. Yow, sister. Wow. And did she look like the kind of woman who was thinking, I wonder how you spend your Sunday mornings at
definitely.
The time? She did.
Definitely. She thinks those things all the time. And what goes on a farm on a Sunday morning stays on a farm.
So how much courage did it take to call her up, Stuart?
Yeah, a little bit. Fiona, I'd have to say, first interaction was a little bit Joe Cool. So immaturely, I played Joe Cool back and took a little while, about a week or so. That's a long time for me.
So she doesn't write it like that. She writes it like you were much more interested in that. That's the benefit when she writes the book, isn't it?
That's yeah. Right. No, so, I got hold of her and we just started chatting on the phone, and it was lovely thinking back to those times.
And, of course, Stuart's great benefit is he clearly is bilingual. He can speak in a city as well as country.
That's right.
But you couldn't. You weren't bilingual.
No, I wasn't.
So what did you make out of the phrase when Stuart said something like, I could chew the arse out of a low-flying duck? What he meant by that?
No, I sought instant clarification. You can chew the arse out of a what?
Of course, seeing each other and going out together, you have to negotiate those differences. Tell me about that dinner party that Fiona took you along to in Adelaide.
Yeah, we had another... early on, we went to a dinner party, very nice friends of Fiona's, where I think they check out the new man. I'd have to say, after many years of growing cotton, I tend to... Before I walk in the door at dinner parties, I put on the bulletproof vest and
get ready for it.
Prepare
yeah.
myself. And that night was no exception. And I have to say, when I get questioned about being a farmer and in particular having grown cotton, it seems to come from a very genuine place from people where they are interested and they want to know more and they do have questions and things don't seem to make sense. So it was a challenge. I mean, I think I had 3 sets of eyes really looking at me closely that night. And I basically try and tell it how I see it on my farm.
People tend to bring it up apropos of nothing at all. They tend to say, so, cotton, eh? Is that how it goes?
Big time. Taxi drivers, the whole lot. And I really try and avoid, sometimes if I'm a little bit tired and I've had a long day and I jump in a taxi and someone when I was a farmer, was asking me what I did, I might tell them I grew grain, and that would sort of calm things down a little bit.
Because you just didn't feel like having that conversation.
Yeah, and I feel bad sometimes for piking out on that, but I'd have to say 99% of the time I'm quite enthusiastic about having the discussion and the debate, and that night was no different.
So when it was put to you that it was a wasteful use of scarce water resources and the like, and similar arguments that have taken place against cotton farming in Australia, what would you say?
Yeah, the basic way I try and have people look about this is farmers deal with a set amount of water, and that water is an allocation. And how that farmer applies the water to a crop, or what crop they apply it to, really is not particularly that's not the key question. So whether it is cotton or rice or dairy or wheat, what the farmer is doing is turning a fixed amount of water, and that's where the big discussion should be had regarding allocation. But once we've had the discussion about how much should a farmer be allocated, where they put it, the farmer is really trying to do their best to turn that water resource into a physical resource or a commodity. Cotton has a particular place in doing that. So does rice, and so does citrus, and so on. So
what you'd say is it wasn't so much about what the crop is, it's really about how much water is being used.
That's correct. That's correct. Each crop turns a set amount of water into a different amount of money. So when the price of wheat goes up, as it has been very high in the last couple of years, due to world food shortages, cotton stops being grown in western Queensland or in western New South Wales, and people start irrigating wheat. So we don't tend to talk about banning wheat now. Farmers tend to roll with the prices, roll with the commodities, and that seems to be how cotton has been branded, because it is quite good at turning a fixed amount of water into an amount of money.
I read at the dinner party you turned it round by asking about what they thought how much water went into a litre of milk, producing a litre of milk.
That's right. And over the years, and I have to say, having worked so closely with natural resources, I look at every commodity and see water. So I look at your shirt and I see 1,000 litres. I look at my jeans and I see a little bit more. I don't actually see the shirt anymore. And so when I see a bowl of custard, I see 500 litres of water. And that's just basically the way I perceive the world now.
You also asked the question about whether, well, what you're wearing is cotton, as you say, and what are the ethics of that? I mean, that's an interesting thing as well, Fiona.
Being in rural Australia taught me that if I, for example, as a city person, is going to get on my high horse about water resource management, I need to be very clear about what it is that I'm consuming or wearing. One of the things that fascinated me about Stu was he was allocated an amount of water, and during dry times and drought, he self-regulated in the use of that allocation of water. So one of the things I'd put to my city friends when they said to me, oh, you're going out with a cotton farmer, is, well, would you rather that Stu use his full allocation of water and plant hemp? Or would you rather he reduce his allocation to 20% and plant cotton? Which would you rather? Because when he plants cotton, he's actually using less water than if he uses all of that water he's been allocated by the government on another crop, whether it be hemp or sorghum or if he was running cattle.
So you want to get past the politics of gesture, in other words, really. I suppose that's what's more visually acceptable rather than to what actually uses more or less water. Well, I'm just wondering, after that dinner party, how that went over with your friends. I mean, obviously, you must have been feeling a little bit nervous when that kind of conversation was taking place.
That's right. They were two people I really wanted to impress. But, you know, Jason, one of the dinner party attendees, really took it to heart and started thinking, yes, well, you know, here I am asking Stu about his farming practices, and yet I'm wearing a cotton T-shirt, I'm wearing cotton jeans. You know, do I care enough to potentially change my buying habits? You know, am I prepared to go out and find a T-shirt made with hemp.
And are you?
Well, I am, but Jason wasn't.
Okay. Wasn't.
So it was a very useful
discussion. So did the friends give Stuart the tick afterwards? Did they?
Big time.
Big time? Wow. Yeah. You must have felt like you were being looked at under a microscope, Stuart.
Look, I'd have to say after the Grow Your Own experience where we had, and I'm not sure how many listeners listened to the Bush Telegraph program, I've been under a lot bigger microscope than two people at a dinner party. And I don't mind that. I believe in what I did. I try and do the best I can, and I'm really happy to have that discussion with anyone. And the key is I'll talk about what I do, and the farming is full of individual farmers trying to do what they think's right.
My guest this morning, married couple Fiona and Stuart Higgins. Fiona, a Sydney career girl. Stuart, a career cotton farmer, as he was back then, who met and formed a romance. And Fiona went to live with Stuart in rural Queensland, where he was growing cotton. Why get into cotton in the first place, Stuart?
As with most things in life, it's never really planned. I had some water left over at the end of a winter season. We just had a very dry winter season, and we'd had a little bit of rain, and I had some water left over, and I spoke to an agronomist, and I said, should I plant irrigated wheat very late and have my yield potential cut back right from the start because the growing season is too small or too short, or should I hold it over and try and grow a summer crop and lose a bit in evaporation but try and make some more money and get the maximum out of the water that I've got in the dam? And the agronomist said to me, look, why don't you give cotton a go? I hate to say it, ignorance and lack of sort of, I thought, why not? Why don't we try it? I looked at the figures and thought it looked like a fascinating crop. A lot goes into it. And
what put you off farming cattle?
Waking up in the morning and having to go over to the neighbour's place and bring one back from the neighbour's place and have to, I loved them. I studied animal production at university. We had a severe drought. I had a couple of bad experiences with calving and having to you know pull calves and calves dying and a cow dying and
too sad was it in the end?
It was a little bit too sad. I mean they were part of my growing up cattle. My first introduction to agriculture was on a beef cattle property way out west with a guy that I sort of wanted to be, wanted to grow up looking like that or being like that. Maybe not looking like that, I basically drifted out of cattle due to those experiences and moved into the cropping side of things.
I love the story of how you found water on your property. Tell that story.
Yeah. Well, now thinking back, when I started farming, I was 21, and I can't even think how a 21-year-old thinks now, but it was the middle of the big 91-92 drought, and I was running out of water. We only had some very small dams on the farm then, and I got a drilling contractor to come in and drill four holes for me.
Were you in big trouble at this stage?
Oh, big trouble. Serious. I'd been farming for less than a year and had no idea, came straight out of university. Cole Markham, who, if you can create a mental image of what a drilling contractor's like, who's been doing it for 40 years.
He's that guy?
He's that man. He's it. Personified. Anyway, he came out. We sank four holes, all dry. And just remember, each time you sink a borehole on your farm, you're devaluing it, proving there's no water underneath your farm.
And what does it cost you to do that?
It was about $2,500. I had $10,000, which was everything.
So you did $10,000 on four holes?
$10,000 on four. They're 4 inches wide and or in diameter. And
so you dug four holes, found nothing, which devalued your property, and you'd spent $10,000 to do that.
That's correct. And
what happened then?
Cole Markham, the champion that he is said to me, you're giving it a go, young fella. We'll throw the last one in for free. And by this stage, I had a guy called Cole Size out, and he did the wire trick. I had the seismologist. I did the science. I did the witchery. I did everything. And when Cole Markham and I were talking, my dog was in the back of the ute, Haley. She was quite a young dog at that time, and she jumped off the ute and ran over into the middle of a paddock, right in the middle of a paddock. No, nothing particular about it. And did a crap on the ground. Drill here, I said. Well, as good as any, as good as any. And he drilled there and, found water.
That's great.
Yeah.
What kind of, Do you believe in divining? You know, that act of water divination? I just wonder if your dog has that sense.
I never asked her and she never told me.
She never told you.
But, you know, her tail right. did a little. I didn't watch it that closely, but I think her tail moved a bit. And all
So after that dinner party in Adelaide you'd had together, you'd been together for about, I don't know, was it 16 days or something, and you received an unusual package in the mail.
Yeah.
What was in that package, Fiona?
Well, when I opened the package, dust fell out of it, and I was quite concerned. I didn't know what it was. And when I removed the item from the tissue paper in which it was wrapped, it was a pair of old boots.
When you say old, what do you mean?
Well, they looked extremely old. I don't know how old they were, but they were well worn.
Dirty?
Were covered in mud. They stank. They stank. And I immediately thought, because I knew it was from Stu, I immediately thought, oh, God, what's this guy?
He's mad.
Exactly. He's balmy. But there was a letter furled in the ankle of one of the boots, and it was an extremely moving letter, which basically said, look, I've been farming now for 10 odd years. I know you don't understand anything about farming or agriculture.
Wait a minute. It began with the most beautiful romantic flourish.
I know. It still gives me tingles.
Tell me what the first thing you read in that letter. At the risk of embarrassing poor Stu.
Well, that's right. That's right. He told me not to lay it on thick, so I'm... He said, Fiona, I'm in love with you. And honestly, I mean, I gasped. I was totally taken aback because we'd only been on two dates and they were wonderful. But it shocked me that he would just say that. And, I was beside myself, really. Thrilled but also frightened that he would put it all out there like that.
Stuart, what's wrong with a bunch of flowers? Why
exactly.
a pair of smelly boots?
I'm now slowly starting to reveal what farmers do on a Sunday morning. They sit down and think up things like that.
God. What did the boots mean for you? What was that a symbol of to you?
Oh, look, it was for me, the symbol was that the boots had seen all I had done and had been with me. They were the one thing that had done everything that I had done on the farm. And I wanted Fiona to somehow share that and to experience that. And that was about the only way I could try and symbolically involve her in my life to that point.
They were you, to somewhere.
Definitely. They were me, yeah.
It's one of the most thoughtful and romantic things that could ever happen to someone like that. You must have been, I don't know, tell me what your feelings were upon reading that and receiving that package.
I was stunned and thrilled, and my gut response was, wow, I could definitely love this man back. I think I might already, but there was another part of me that was very used to taking things slowly, and that part of me was quite daunted by the fact that I'd known this person for not very long, and here he was declaring this almost undying love for me.
Were you frightened by the passion of it?
A little. I was frightened by the possible ramifications of the passion because, you know, where if you're loving each other after 16 days, what then?
It's a risky thing to do as well, Stuart. You must have been quite confident of her reaction because someone less sensitive than Fiona may consider that a kind of an act of stalking. Can receive something like that in the mail.
Maybe.
Well, I don't misconstrue it.
Yeah, I certainly didn't know how she would respond. And for me, it was a risk putting it all out there. But if it didn't work, I'd be 1,200 kilometres away and she'd be down there. And I suppose it was there was safety in that if it didn't work, I could hide for quite a while. Yeah.
It seems one of the things that really help you make up your mind about Stuart was when you took him to see your dad, who had been suffering for many, many years from multiple sclerosis and was in hospital. Just describe that encounter to me, please, Fiona.
My dad was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis 2 years after he married my mum, so he was very young, he was 24. And he'd been hospitalised in a particular facility since 1987. And he hadn't spoken to me for more than 18 months. He was very affected physically and mentally, so he was very cognitively impaired. And it was always painful to visit, but particularly difficult to take Stuart because he was physically devastated and incapable of communicating. And when I took Stu to see him, I thought we would sort of go through the motions, which we did. I said, "Dad, you know, I've brought you someone very special to meet. This is my friend." I think I described Stu at the time, Stuart Higgins. And Stu, much to my, delight and sadness and you know, I can't really describe it, he grasped my father's hand with a sort of a manliness and a sort of such respect. And he shook his hand and he said, "Hello, Mr. Collins, it's a really wonderful pleasure knowing your daughter. I'm Stuart Higgins." And my father said, "Stuart Higgins." And I thought, I leant forward because I thought, no, I just imagined that. He didn't say the word Stuart Higgins. And I said, "Dad, what did you just say?" And he repeated the words Stuart Higgins.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web. Today my guests are married couple Fiona Higgins and Stuart Higgins. And they're telling their story of how they met at a conference, Fiona a career girl and Stuart a cotton farmer. They forged an unlikely romance, and how Fiona came to live with Stuart on his cotton farm in outback Queensland, rural Queensland I should say, not outback by any means. So there you were very much a couple, and your relationship was badly tested, and I love this story, because of the ethical leadership program you went on. and Stuart quite wisely realised that an ethical leadership program leads you into all sorts of ethical dilemmas. You'd been on this course before, hadn't you, Stuart?
Yeah, I had. I did it 2 years before Fiona was selected on it, so I'd already gone through the program. It's quite an intense, it's intense and it is over a long period of time. You're put through a whole set of sort of dilemmas, and you sort of trained or tried to think about how you would build a framework on making decisions with what's put in front of you. So,
but in that process, it's quite easy to bond with the other people.
For sure. You go through a lot of shared experiences, and that tends to bring out that type of relationship.
And it nearly did finish your relationship for good, this program you went on. Just tell me what happened as best you can, Fiona.
Sure. Well, I developed an intense friendship with someone on the program. And although there was never any infidelity, there was enough emotional connection there to threaten my relationship with Stu, particularly given that we were doing this long-distance relationship thing, and that had its own stresses. There's only so many emails and telephone calls you can have. Stu was also pursuing some of his consulting work overseas. The program was taking me to multiple destinations. We were spending a lot of time apart. And Stu was also experiencing drought. So distance and drought weren't doing us any favours. But primarily, I developed a strong relationship with someone else, albeit
A
friendship relationship.
Yes. Yeah. So you wrote two letters, one to Stuart, one to this other guy.
Yeah.
Without any intention of sending them.
No, that's right. I've always been a diary keeper since age 9, and one of the ways I make sense of my lived experience is to write stuff out, and it's just stuff. Mental vomit quite a lot of the
mental
time.
mental vomit, yes. I think that's the technical name for it, isn't it? Yes.
And so I wrote these two letters at a time when I was particularly mixed up, trying to work out what was going on for me.
And overcoming an ambivalence, you couldn't figure out why you couldn't get past that either.
That's right, yeah.
So you came home one night and discovered that Stuart had seen just the one letter, the one you'd written to him.
That's right.
Never to 20%, but the one never to be sent to the other guy.
That's right.
And he left a note for you. What did it say?
Well, it was pretty harsh. He said, "You're now free to act on your feelings for Hugh. You are not a nice person." And that was it. So I found my diary open and the two letters, one untouched, the one that was meant for Stu. I suspect if he'd read that one, perhaps his response might have been slightly attenuated, but he only read the letter to Hugh, and quite justifiably, I think, given its chaotic contents, its diary stuff, he left.
So what did you do?
I cried. I cried volumes. And then I tried to get in touch with him for 6 months, but I discovered that, and I knew this, that Stu is not one to be slighted. He does things boots and all, literally boots and all,
yes. And
you have the boots. Mm. I had messed around the edges for too long, and justifiably he wasn't interested in an instant
reunification. Oh, you're breaking his heart, that's why.
Exactly,
yeah.
So,
but then you had an epiphany. The oddest thing in the world, this dreamy sort of moment.
Yeah.
How would you describe that?
I'd describe it as an almost meditative trance. I mean, again, I've always been somebody who uses relaxation techniques and meditation as a way to relax. I wasn't meditating as such, but I was gazing at a candle and very sad. And something, an out-of-body type experience occurred for me where I almost had a visual representation of this thing that was making me ambivalent, that was making me skirt around the edges of our relationship. And this thing was like a vapor, black vapor, was trying to get inside of me. And I basically told it to back off. And after that experience, I felt as though I had beaten something internally.
Were you able to rationalise it later?
No. It's one of those experiences where it sort of defies words, actually.
But you got some insight into what your ambivalence was all about?
Yeah. I think I always knew rationally what my ambivalence was about, and a lot of it was around what I'd seen my parents go through. What did marriage mean to me as a child watching my dad suffer? What did a relationship mean? Well, quite often it meant caretaking, and I was not interested in being in that sort of relationship. So any relationship potentially was threatening for me.
So you banished that thought? That
It was interesting. The thought remained, but something had shifted in my heart. So while I could still, I didn't banish the thought, I banished the feeling. And it took some kind of out-of-body type experience for that to happen. Something went clunk inside.
So you wrote Stuart a letter and then you called him to say, you are coming.
That's right.
What did she say in that phone call, Stuart?
Well, what did she tell me?
Did she tell you? Yes, that's what I mean.
she told me she was coming and that she was putting it on the line and going to be up within days. I think it was 3 or 4 days.
Coming to visit?
No. Coming for good. Putting the career, going in and saying that's it. At that point. And saying that she was going to come up to rural Queensland. But
you'd broken up.
We had broken up. We had. I was a cranky camper. certainly even at that point didn't really sort of throw the arms open and say we're all right to go. So she didn't even have the security of knowing that she was going to be welcomed with open arms. So
you gave up the place in Sydney?
Yes.
Found a way to work by long distance?
Yes, I was very fortunate in that regard that when I announced that I was moving to rural Queensland, my employer and I had a discussion, and the end of that discussion was, well, why don't you see if you can make it work from rural Queensland, which I then proceeded to try to do.
So you get on a plane and get to Brisbane, get the Greyhound.
That's right. He wouldn't come and collect me from the airport.
Well,
I had to
enough.
Do it the hard
Quite
way.
Frankly, fair enough.
I know.
You know, that's suppose you had to wait.
Thanks for that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Have you been for the last few years?
We're members of the same club. We've got a secret handshake and stuff, being men. So with that, I don't know, where were you dropped off? You were dropped off at a petrol station somewhere.
That's right, in Dalby. Which is about 45 kilometres away from Jandowie.
In the Darling Downs, and finally Stuart arrived. How glad were you to see that ute?
I was very glad, but I was also very nervous because it was very clear that, as Stuart said, he wasn't going to be, Mr. Passionate. I knew he was going to be Joe Cool for at least a while. In fact, I wasn't clear whether or not the relationship was going to be able to be mended.
How long was Joe Cool there for? How long did that last for?
Joe Cool lasted for the 35-minute ride from the service station in the Shell service station in Dalby to the front steps at Jandowie.
Because quite frankly, you've got an attractive blonde in the car with you. Did you think that was really the upshot of the situation?
Yeah, well, nothing was going to happen in the car, but still. I waited until we got to the farm and then I just couldn't hide my delight anymore. But it wasn't really a delight. It was relief. It was a lot of emotions thrown in there at that time, but it was nice to be standing there with her.
And he carried you across the threshold.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. He said, well, we might as well do it right from now.
And Stuart, you built her a donga. Now, I feel that the word donga needs to be translated because there are a lot of people who would not know what a donga is and probably have a bad idea of what it might be.
Yes, well, after the chew the arse out of a low-flying duck, it could be anything.
Could be.
So a donga, just a demountable building.
Right.
So I laid.
It's a shed normally. It's
just a
shed, yes.
Yeah, with a satellite dish and an air conditioner and sitting on some gravel.
Oh, I mean, how many guys did you know before that could knock up a demountable building with a satellite and all that?
None.
What did you think once you'd seen the donga that he built for you?
What did I think?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I thought it was fantastic.
God, you can make things.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I was used to
web designers,
and men with soft hands.
That's right. So then you have to acclimatise to this new life. Tell me about seeing your first green tree frog in the house.
Green tree frog. Look, they lived in the toilet,
In the bowl.
In the bowl, yep, and in the cistern, I guess.
You're going to be checking that bowl then, aren't you?
Well, initially, yes, but by the end of my time in Jandowie, I'd just lift the lid, see them there, and then just relieve myself, irrespective of the
really?
Fact that, yeah, absolutely. You get
That's
very
what they want?
Well, they don't mind.
They don't mind.
They're in there for a reason.
They haven't
it's
complained yet.
Climate controlled. It's safe from the snakes. But yeah, on my first it was my first day at Jandowie, I opened the bathroom door and one of the frogs had been up in the guide rail, and as I opened the door, its leg was amputated. And it started to croak, and then the frog leg fell with a thunk practically on my lap, and there was blood streaming everywhere. You know, its friends were unhappy, and Stu had to come out and rescue me, the vegetarian with eyes brimming who'd just amputated a frog leg. You know, but I toughened up.
You toughened up?
Yeah, I did.
Had the Bush Telegraph alerted everyone to your arrival in Jandowie?
Yeah, absolutely. I went my first foray into Jandowie. I went looking for a soy latte, which is my coffee of choice.
Oh, seriously?
I know, but I was green. I was green as anything. I had no idea.
You asked for a soy latte.
She was green, trust me.
It's bad enough asking for that in the city, let alone in a country town.
It's not a real coffee, is it? No, I shouldn't even bother. But yeah, look. And the guy, of course, behind the counter, you know, informed me that they don't do soy lattes in rural Queensland.
You get instant coffee instead.
That's right. But he then said, oh, I suppose it's hotter up here than down south, eh? So he knew exactly where I was from. You know, he knew I was the Sheila from Sydney who'd come to live on Stu's farm. And, you know, this unfolded in the rest of town. I walked into the post office and the news agent, and tried to buy a newspaper and a couple of chocolate bars. And the woman behind the counter, whom I'd never met, said, oh, do you want to put that on the account? And I said, I don't have an account. She said, well, you kind of do because Stu does. And she knew who I was. Everyone had been talking.
Had you arranged this warm welcome?
No.
You hadn't gone around and given a stern word to everyone, Stuart, saying, now she's from the city. Be nice.
Contrary to going on radio and speaking to, you know, faces you've never seen before and divulging every minute detail in your life, I'm actually quite a private person, if you'd believe so. No one had any forewarning. I think the only person that really knew much about what was going on was a lady would come out and clean, and her husband would help out once a week, and she probably had the greatest idea of what was going on, and it only takes one for it all to go.
And it turned out that a woman called Becky had told everyone what you were doing. No matter where you went, Becky said you were doing this, this, this.
That's right.
Did you know Becky?
No.
Did you know anything about Becky?
No, I didn't. No, Becky was, in fact, a friend of a friend of the cleaning lady. So.
Right, friend of a friend of the cleaning lady. Yeah. Becky knew everything about but you didn't have the first idea who Becky was.
That's right.
Tell me about the hardware shop you went into that operates on an honor system.
Yeah, one day Stu asked me to, while I was in at town, pick up some batteries for him. So I went into the hardware store and it was about lunchtime. I opened the door and looked up the back to see if I could see any staff members. No one appeared to be there. I thought, oh gosh, what's going on? And then my eye fell on a note, and a previous customer had come in and left a note saying, Bob, I took a washer, here's $2, ta, Roger. And I realised that in fact the shop was unmanned and was operating on an honour system during lunchtime. And the newsagent then informed me that that was the case, that the hardware store owner would go home for lunch with his wife and just leave the store open for people like me who might pop in during lunch hour, need something, and just leave our money on the counter.
Stuart, people listening in the city will think this is charming and extraordinary and lovely, but this wouldn't be... listeners in the country would be going, well, so what? I suppose a lot of...
Yeah, I'm sitting here myself going, so what? It's the way it works. It's that's everyone knows each other, and once you've got that connection... I'm not surprised. You probably should know that Bob always goes home for lunch with his wife, and you shouldn't really go in there. So that's how it works. Everyone knows how everyone runs their lives, and you try and work around it.
My guests today are married couple Fiona and Stuart Higgins, and Fiona's written the story of how they came together in their unlikely romance called Love in the Age of Droughts. Now, it's also got the world's best postal service in Jandaui, as you've discovered. Tell me how that worked for you.
Yeah. It came to my attention pretty early on that if I didn't have a stamp for an envelope, I wouldn't need to drive the 14 kilometres into Jandaui to visit the post office to buy a stamp. All I'd need to do would be to leave the envelope in our mailbox. Then the postman would collect the envelope, I'd leave $10.
From your mailbox?
From my mailbox, pick up my money, take it into Jandaui, buy the stamp for me, and then the next day return my change and leave it in the mailbox with the next day's mail. So service with a smile. And
I'm just going, wow. And again, you're probably thinking, well, no big deal, Stuart, this is commonplace.
I think they went, that's commonplace. They went above and beyond the call of duty when they would drive into the farm, open Fiona's office door and put the mail in her in tray. That surprised me, but that's what it's like.
That's right.
it's such a lovely story. And making that adjustment, we were talking earlier about the dinner party where you were brought in, Stuart, in Adelaide, in the Adelaide Hills, to meet Fiona's inner city friends. The situation was reversed. You were invited by Wilma, another local, to come to dinner. How difficult was it for you to explain what a vegetarian was? Sorry, a soy latte drinking vegetarian.
I seem to have inordinate difficulties because I thought, you know, once you say the word vegetarian, it's pretty clear to most people. But it turned out that it wasn't so. And whenever I said, oh, look, you know, by the way, I'm a vegetarian, people would say, oh, well, I've made a lovely tuna casserole, or, you know, I've made a chicken quiche. Will that be fine? Then I'd have to say, well, no, you know, a chicken or a fish, you know, they're technically animals and I don't eat any form of animal-derived protein. And so then, of course, you know, it was all on, well, what did I eat? And it was always a point of contention. But once we overcame that hurdle, of course, what would be put on would be just this amazing, amazing feast of vegetables and cheesy sauce, and people would just go out of their way to make an extraordinary dinner for me, even though
I think you ate beautifully.
I did. I ate better in rural Australia than I did in Sydney.
When did you realise that Sydney was losing its shine for you as a place to live? You went back there, and
I did.
How did that realisation come upon you?
It came upon me quite early. So on my first visit, which was within 5 weeks of being in Jandowie, I relished the return to Sydney. I loved it. But in subsequent return visits, so from roughly the, you know, 2 or 3 month mark, I started to get impatient with the amount of people in Sydney, and I started to, you know, I started to do silly things like lose my keys, because, of course, in Jandowie we didn't have a key to our house. You know, we'd leave the place and just leave the door open. And yet in Sydney I'd have keys for, you know, my security building pass, a key to my, you know, hotel room or wherever I was staying, and I'd start to lose my keys. And everything about the city had lost its appeal for me, particularly around proximity to nature. I was loving the open spaces of Jandowie. And
so back at Jandowie, Stuart proposed marriage. How did he do it?
Yeah, well, he did it quite quickly after my arrival, within 2 months, I think. And it was a treasure hunt, effectively. I woke up one morning, there was an alarm blared, and we'd never used an alarm before, and I found a little note saying, look, you know, go outside and make sure you're wearing a pair of boots and long pants, because today is a very special day. And then this was the first in roughly 6 steps that took me all through the farm, arriving ultimately at a special tree down by the creek where Stuart had hidden an engagement ring. And finally, after these 5 or 6 steps, which I'd been navigating by myself, he popped out from behind the tree and proposed. So it was a very romantic moment.
You had to say yes under those circumstances.
Well, I had to, yes. It had taken me about 2.5 hours to find the ring.
So it was a quick engagement, but then it rained just before the wedding. What did that mean? What do you have to do when it rained like that? What did that mean for you, Stuart?
Well, it was quite an intense time. I'd been away in Mozambique doing some consultancy work, which I'd started doing as a result of the drought to A, get some off-farm income, and B, keep my mind active. Racing back to Toowoomba, I didn't even get a chance to see Fiona a day or two before the wedding. I raced back out to the farm. It meant starting up pumps and trying to capture some of the water that's flowing past down the creek. It was one of those creeks where when it floods, it really floods, and when it's dry, it's really dry. So, I had to go and see the other girlfriend, which was the farm at the time. Mm. It was quite a quite an intense time, and we captured some water, and I raced back and got married.
This was the drought, as you say. And when did you realise, and you were having problems with your cotton crop, when did you realise there was a problem? What did you see?
A season or two later, the growing cotton, we had an issue where, unfortunately, a contractor failed to clean a particular herbicide out of a boom spray, and the quantity that it was left in there was absolutely minute, but it takes hardly any to create a problem.
So it poisoned the crop?
Yeah, it did. It deformed the crop and impacted the yield, and that was another challenging time, another sort of step in the process of difficult farming for me.
So you have this blooming relationship with Fiona, the one girlfriend, if you like, it's going extremely well, but the other girlfriend, now the farm, is breaking your heart.
Yeah, one, I mean, my love's growing eternally, and the other, I'm losing the love. Thankfully I had some love growing eternally somewhere.
So that meant you had to start thinking of giving it up?
Yeah, yeah. It certainly wasn't a wake up one morning and it's all over kind of decision. And one thing drought did was, because I started going off farm and doing other things, and it showed me other things happening, and I found them interesting, and I sort of slowly started not finding the very important small things that have to be done on a farm perfectly as stimulating. After a while, I realised that farming wasn't doing it for me as much as it probably should.
And meanwhile, you were loving the life.
Yes.
Starting to really love the life.
Yes, I was. So I'd gone from not being able to boil an egg in Sydney to, you know, winning the local Jandowi scone baking competition.
You won the scone baking
competition. I did.
What do you get, a trophy or a ribbon for that?
A lovely white certificate. And I still have it.
But sadly, you had to give it up. You had to sell the farm.
Yeah, I made the decision. It took 2 years. Interestingly, in those 2 years, I had some quite good seasons. I grew sorghum. As I alluded to earlier, the grain prices were good. But I was committed. It was the right thing to do for me. We sold the farm, waiting patiently for 2 years, and we now live in Sydney.
You feel a little heartbroken about this, don't you, Fiona? Because how many years did you have on the farm then?
I had 3 growing seasons, so 3 years. But it wasn't long enough for me. I feel a little robbed. And if Stu said tomorrow, you know, I've had enough of the city and I'd like us to explore another agricultural pursuit in rural Australia, I'd say, well, I'll be right there with you.
You got a little boy now. Are you thinking that, you know, a country upbringing, nothing like it for little kids?
Yeah, that was certainly, when we left, I was pregnant and that was certainly in my mind. And when we sold the farm last year, finally, he, you know, was over a year old and loving tractors and all of those things that little boys love. So certainly I feel sad that we can't offer that to
him. Do you think you'll go back? Do you think you'll return? Are you going a bit mad in the city, both of you?
No, I'm not going too mad in the city. I do a few things that keep stop me from doing that. But, I would think one day. I mean, our son will, if he wishes to choose that opportunity. I wasn't a farmer's son and I became a farmer. So if that's where he wishes to go, that's fine. We reached a point where if I'm not happy on the farm, then being there with my son probably still wouldn't be a good thing. So,
meanwhile, you're going to Africa and consulting on agricultural projects all over the world these days.
Yeah, that's quite interesting.
Oh, well, it's fascinating to find how your life has evolved over time. It's a really great love story. It's a fantastic love story. And thank you so much for submitting yourselves to my poking and prodding among the story of your love affair and your relationship. Thank you so much, Fiona. Thanks. And Stuart Higgins, for joining me in conversation today.
Thank you, Richard.
Thanks, Richard.
And Fiona's book is called Love in the Age of Drought: A Career Girl, a Cotton Farmer, and an Unlikely Romance.
On ABC Local Radio, Conversations with Richard Feidler.